This is Lorne Greene. It all seems so obvious to us now, for the past to look back upon. But to those who lived it, with no such past to guide them, all was mystery and terror, and even worse, contradiction. "We hold these truths to be self-evident," declared Thomas Jefferson in 1776. But to him, those truths were anything but self-evident 1 year earlier, when he wrote, "We mean not to dissolve that union which has so long and so happily subsisted between us. We have not raised armies with ambitious designs of separation from Great Britain and establishing independent states." No taxation without representation. What principle could be more self-evidently just? Yet in 1765, when the British passed the Stamp Act, no such principle had ever existed in America or England. What then did those vociferous colonists of 1775 really think they were doing? And why? The strangeness of it all deepens when we turn to the shadowy, remote, godlike figure of George Washington. Our 20th century minds can scarcely grasp what really moved him and why. But that is exactly what we are going to probe in the story you are about to hear.
Mutual Radio Theater, a new adventure in radio listening. 5 nights of exceptional entertainment every week, brought to you in Elliot Lewis's production of the Mutual Radio Theater. Our story, The Mutiny Against George Washington, by Edward Borgers. Our stars, Fletcher Markle and Tommy Cook.
We'll now hear about the mutiny against George Washington from a soldier of the Revolution who knew Washington well.
My name is Kenneth Hawkins, Continental Army. Yes, I did know the commander. Met him in a strange way, to be sure. And yes, I was there at the mutiny. The beginnings, though, I had to get from my cousins, John Adams and Sam Adams. You see, I was rather busy at the time, at a couple of places called Lexington and Concord. But on May 17th, 1775, John and Sam were in Philadelphia at the Second Continental Congress. And the news from my part of the country hit Philadelphia just in time to give that Congress a real lift.
Sam, it wasn't just a British defeat, it was a rout.
We chased them, John, like terriers after an alley cat. Another half mile to Charleston and they'd have trampled on each other. Now it's only a question of how much time before we drive them into the sea.
Nothing like a little good news to set the whole Congress afire.
Well, it's done that all right, for all except our stone-faced giant from Virginia. Outside there, through the window, the one dressed in his scarlet uniform. Stands out from the rest of us drab exhibits like a cockatoo and a flock of sparrows.
You're speaking of Colonel Washington, of course.
Colonel? Oh, you mean that uniform isn't a fake? That iceberg really is a soldier?
He served with Braddock and at Fort Necessity. Disasters both, but they've certainly given him more experience than most colonial officers.
Well, well.
It is odd he doesn't seem more pleased with a military victory in Massachusetts.
Oh, come, John. Don't be naive. Is one prima donna delighted with another prima donna when she hits a perfect high C?
Outside, right at this moment, the tall, stately figure my cousins were talking about was walking toward the State House. He moved slowly, staring down, oblivious of those hurrying past him.
Mr. Washington, sir, good morning, Colonel Washington.
Yes.
I'm Perkins from the Pennsylvania Packet. These are grave times, Colonel Washington.
The gravest, sir.
Colonel, in these days when the fate of all of us hangs by a thread, what are you thinking about?
I've been studying the bricks in Philadelphia's streets.
Bricks?
If you will measure, sir, you will find that one brick is 10 inches long by 3 inches wide.
Yes, sir.
12 bricks laid end to end make a road 3 inches wide and 10 feet across. 4 such bricks laid side by side make 1 foot wide.
True.
How many feet in a mile?
5,280.
Times 4 bricks wide equals 21,120. Times 12 bricks across equals 253,440 bricks for 1 mile of Philadelphia brick road 10 feet wide.
Yes, sir. Colonel Washington, do you know what is to be discussed today by Congress?
I understand it's a wordy debate on the natural rights of man.
You're not interested in the debate, Colonel?
Abstractions bore me.
Good morning, Mr. Washington.
Greetings, Colonel.
John Adams, Samuel Adams, good morning, sirs.
Wonderful news from Boston.
We have provoked the British, certainly, let us hope not fatally so.
Are you sorry, Colonel Washington?
I fear bloodshed in this business is inevitable. I'm sorry that it's begun before we have even the shadow of an army.
Still, I'd rather have been with the Minutemen at Concord than with poor Pitcairn's gorgeous redcoats.
That was the success of a puppy nipping at the rear shank of a sleeping bulldog. I would not count on it as general practice.
What do you think should be done, Colonel?
I am not one who believes the roused wrath of the armies of the king will be a festival of joy.
No.
Nor I.
At present, our colonies are 13 puppies, erratic, running about in 100 directions, yapping at each other, waiting to be gulped up one at a time at the English bulldog's leisure.
And your prescription, Colonel?
13 bands of gypsies who call themselves colonial militia must be welded into one army, representing one people under one command, able to move anywhere, anytime, in any way, as one unit. Otherwise, we all sit here waiting for doom.
One army? From militias as different from each other as Arabs and Eskimos? How would you achieve that?
With the great leveler of all human distinctions, discipline.
A high price, Colonel.
Too high for justice? Too high to save representative government? Excuse me, gentlemen.
John, would you let me stand in the sun for a few hours? I need thawing out.
Colonel Washington's not a man who overwhelms you with cordiality, is he?
Still, what he said about the need for one commander, one army, one nation, he wasn't totally wrong, you know.
Well, here comes the member of Congress least likely to agree with anybody. Let's see what he says.
Morning, Dillon. Beautiful day.
Rain, probably.
Little trouble with the King's army up in Concord.
Be more. You can count on that.
We're going to have to stand together against the common threat.
I reckon Rhode Island will take no more sass in Massachusetts.
There's talk we should get all our armed forces together under a single commander.
I don't know.
Personally, I'm against it.
You? You, Sam? You're against it? For heaven's sake, why?
Why? Well, good Lord, man. You're talking about a giant army. What if it should mutiny?
It's mid-May in 1775, as young Hawkins continues his report on what was happening between his cousins John and Sam Adams at the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia.
Poor cousin John. He thought Sam Adams was his ally. It certainly didn't look that way now.
Sam, I don't understand. Why are
a
you...
A giant army is exactly our problem right now.
Our problem is the tarnal British Parliament.
A big army is always a threat to liberty. Soldiers soon think of themselves as a body distinct from the rest of the citizens. They're used to reaching for their guns and they do what their commanders tell them. I say, he who creates a big army forges his own chains.
I know what you're trying to do, Sam. You're trying to talk me out of an adequate army by a lot of scare stories, but it won't work, see?
Why not?
Because I know we'll never get rid of the King's army unless we have a powerful, single, coordinated army of our own.
And how do you expect to keep such an army from taking over the country?
By having Congress stand over that army like an elephant on a cat's tail. By electing and dismissing their officers as we see fit. By keeping our thumb on every crust of bread they eat and every shirt they put on the backs. By telling them where to go and when to stop. And by being sure they're never too far ahead of starvation.
get a strong Continental Army with a strong Commander-in-Chief and keep them both in their place with a strong Continental Congress. Good day, gentlemen.
Sam, what were you thinking of? You were on the wrong side of that argument with Dillon.
Well, John, in the first place, you will never get a Commander-in-Chief unless you have the support of Nat Dillon and his friends. In the second place, you'll never get Nat's support for anything unless you oppose it yourself. So that's what I did.
That's it.
In the third place, those misgivings were all mine. And I wondered if Nat could give him any kind of an answer. I must say he did pretty well. You know, John, Washington's not the world's great socializer, but he does have the word of the hour, discipline.
He's not a New Englander, Sam. All the fighting's going on in Massachusetts.
Well, that's the point, John. If this is just a New England war, we're going to find ourselves very lonely. We need some solid link to the other end of the country. Make a Southerner commander-in-chief of everybody's army, and you make this everybody's war.
Mm. Can he win battles?
No general wins battles, John. That's the business of soldiers.
I'll nominate him today.
And that's what my cousin John did, all right. And with a leading New Englander making the nomination, it went right through. In the middle of June, the new Commander-in-Chief set out for Cambridge, Massachusetts, to take formal command of his new unified army. It was there that I... It still makes my flesh creep.
All right, boys. The breastworks at Breed's Hill saved at least 200 lives for us. We never know when the King's troops may bust out of Boston looking for us again. Now let's set up some more welcome hills for them.
That makes sense, Lieutenant.
Grab an axe and let's go. Lieutenants ain't supposed to do all the work in this army.
It's Washington.
Salute you, dummies. Welcome to our humble camp, sir.
Who's in charge here?
I am, sir.
Lem's our lieutenant, sir.
Lieutenants?
Yes, sir.
Good man, too, sir.
Best in the army, we think, sir.
Lieutenant, are you aware that officers are not supposed to assist privates in the execution of their chores?
I've heard the regulations, sir. But you see, sir, things are different here in Massachusetts. Up here...
Are you aware that officers are not supposed to assist privates in the execution of their chores?
Yes, sir.
Yet you, an officer who should be setting an example of obedience for all your soldiers, you have taken it upon yourself to disregard the regulation?
Yes, sir.
You, take this rope and tie his hands together tight.
But you see, sir, he was...
Private, you must learn that in the Continental Army, orders from an officer are given only once.
Yes, sir. Put out your hands, man.
Sure.
You, pull down that limb so this man can tie the lieutenant's wrists to the branch.
Yes, sir. Yeah, you got him secured there, Nicholson?
Yep. Yep.
Strip off his shirt.
Me, sir?
You.
Yes, sir.
Who's the drummer here?
Me, sir.
We'll need your whip.
Sir, I have no whip. There's never been such a thing in this camp.
Well, take mine. Here.
Yes, sir.
You will lay the whip on this man's back until I tell you to stop.
Yes, sir.
Harder, drummer. You must leave at least a mark each time. That's better. Continue. 3, 4, 5. Drummer, that will be all. You, cut the ropes that bind the prisoner. Surgeon, tend the offender. When he is conscious again, tell him to report to Captain Johnson for further assignment as private. Are there questions? Gentlemen, this is not a family outing. This is war. Your enemy is the world's best-trained army. Their success is discipline. You must match that discipline. Liberty or slavery, life or death, choose.
That night at General Washington's headquarters, the candle burned late.
What is it?
You sent for me, sir.
Oh, yes. The lad who administered the whipping. Your name?
Hawkins. I'm the company drummer, sir. It seems that's one of my duties.
You did your task well.
Yes, sir.
There were tears in your eyes.
Yes, sir. Lemuel Hawkins is my older brother.
Ah. How do you feel about him now?
Just like I did before. I'm proud of him.
Let me ask you this. Do you think what he did was right?
I think this was a better army when my brother was Lieutenant Hawkins, sir. Every man did his part gladly, because it was something we'd all hatched up together. We were all sharing together, and we were all going to benefit from it together. Now you've shackled our wrists and our feet and our minds. You've been a hand of ice on the Continental Army, sir.
Indeed.
The way we were doing things, we scared the British Army white. I'm not sure whether this new army will have the heart to fight at all. All right. Now shoot me, sir. You asked.
On a June night in 1775, young Hawkins faces General George Washington in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's been asked to speak his mind and has done so boldly.
Washington's face went as still as a painting for about 5 seconds. I didn't figure I had a minute to live. But at that moment, I didn't care. I was a lot madder at General Washington than I was at the British Army. So I just glared at him and waited for the bullet.
If I ask, I want the truth. Do you think these men will desert?
No, sir.
Why not?
Well, sir, we think you're wrong about the whole way you're going at this army. But you may be right. If Parliament chooses, they can make this a lot bigger thing than the little skirmishes we've just had at Concord and Breed's Hill. So maybe it has to be just the way you say. Anyhow, you're what we have, and we stand with you, sir.
Hawkins, I shall need an aide-de-camp. I'm asking to have you transferred to me.
Yes, sir. Wherever I'm needed, sir. That's the kind of general he was, all through the war. Most of the men worshipped him because he never showed fear or dismay. A few noticed that he never showed anything else, either. And a few others... But first, there was victory at Yorktown. British hopes for victory in America collapsed. Peace talks began over in Paris with Benjamin Franklin, head of our delegation. But then the talks bogged down and stalled for months. An American newspaper reporter tried to find out why.
Dr. Franklin, all American citizens are becoming distraught about this peace treaty with Great Britain that never seems to get signed.
I can imagine so.
The peace negotiations are still going on here, aren't they?
Oh, yes, yes. Every day something happens or doesn't happen.
You do realize, Dr. Franklin, it's a terrible strain for us. The United States is in limbo. Neither at peace nor war, neither slave nor free, neither subject nor independent.
That's distressing, certainly.
It's been a year since Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown.
A year and a month.
But British troops still patrol the streets of Manhattan.
It's outrageous.
The American army sits a few miles above New York at Newburgh-on-the-Hudson, not daring to attack for fear of upsetting the negotiations, not daring to go home for fear the negotiations may fail and the war may start again.
Quite so.
Well, sir, can't you demand that the British do something?
I think it would not be wise to signal our unease to the British.
But if there isn't some sort of breakthrough soon, I'm not sure even General Washington can answer for the consequences.
Tell the troops to be patient. Patience is a quality much admired in Europe.
On Friday, March 14th, 1783, the American army was concentrated at Newburgh on the Hudson. That day began the events that precipitated the mutiny and also showed us what kind of man Commander Washington really was. I was stationed with him at his headquarters. Mr. Governor Morris, sir.
Leave us, Hawkins.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Morris?
You know that at any moment we may hear news of the signing of a peace treaty between Great Britain and the United States?
I devoutly hope so.
Ah, indeed. But don't be too devout, General. When that news arrives, we shall all face a new threat.
Oh?
Even in our gravest peril, Congress has been remarkably casual in meeting its financial responsibilities.
That's certainly been true with the Army.
When war pressures stop, this congressional irresponsibility may well increase.
I suppose so.
You can understand that this will be a matter of concern to those of us who loaned millions of dollars to the people of America, always with a clear statement of the inescapable obligations involved.
I understand your concern.
There were also promises by Congress that the Army's brave men and officers were to receive substantial pensions for their sacrifices.
I have struggled for months to get those promises redeemed.
I also. You can picture, General, the possible keenness of disappointment for the Army and for those of us who have loaned money.
I can.
Has it occurred to you, sir, that those disappointments might be dangerous? In honesty, sir.
In honesty? Yes.
You and your army have seen better than anyone else what happens when a government is too weak for survival. You do see that we must have a strong and responsible government.
I see that.
Only one man is acceptable to all factions. The hero of Valley Forge and Yorktown. The living symbol of national unity. That's why you are indispensable when we, the enlightened ones, seize power.
Overthrowing the government that I and the men serving under me have suffered so much to create?
It is your suffering soldiers, General, who demand that I and my friends seize power and that you take the title of Prime Minister, or, if you will, King.
My own soldiers have come to you, but their officers would have forbidden
such... In this case, sir, the officers are the leaders. The whole army has never stood so united or so firm.
On what?
You will be the figurehead. You need command only those matters of immediate interest to yourself. In your name, all men will keep the peace, the most urgent need. I and my friends, who seek no publicity, will do the ruling. We will tame your army with money and tame your irresponsible citizens, in turn, with the army.
And if I refuse?
Your refusal would not change the nation's history. It would only make it bloodier. In any case, the army and I will take control. The nation will remember you, if at all, as the man who failed us when we needed him the most.
It's bad for everyone, including the leader, when any one man has power that no one can question or check. I'm working for a representative government in which all points of view are heard and weighted.
All points of view?
All points of view among property gentlemen.
Ah.
In those same years, I, an experienced and trusted commander in a territory I knew best, was told I must take second rank to English-born officers of lower rank and no ability simply because I was colonial-born. A gentleman of worth and valor shackled simply because of his birth.
Oh, beware, Commander. This way lies Jefferson's mad dog democracy.
I know. I've always been clear that no man could be a gentleman, could have wisdom or character until he had acquired substantial property. Those who dug and spun and built were ants, marvelous in their power and beauty, but also useless and dangerous unless guided by an intelligence of which they themselves were not part.
Of course.
What has made it possible for me to succeed was the certainty that exactly what I was doing was exactly right.
Naturally, and now you...
Now I'm no longer certain.
You're what?
No longer certain.
Not certain?
Jefferson claims that the human ants who labor have wisdom, neither more nor less than that of gentlemen, and character neither better nor worse than that of gentlemen.
I'm aware of Mr. Jefferson's follies.
But I am no longer certain that he is absolutely wrong.
You what?
I am no longer so certain of anything that I am willing to be a party to forcing it on others.
This is a joke. A test.
I never indulge in either.
I hadn't even considered. Your will has cracked. You are a war casualty.
At least, Mr. Morris, to you.
I must salvage what I can.
Lorne Greene again, and here's the fourth act of the mutiny against George Washington.
Hardly had Governor Morris gone out the door than a second visitor arrived in General Washington's office.
Mr. Dillon, thank heaven you've come.
Well, that's an unlikely speech for sure.
Sir, I must tell you about a matter of the gravest consequence.
Indeed you must. Sit down, please, and I'll ask you about it.
But you are
under the command of the Congress, sir. It is for me to ask you questions, not vice versa. Washington, I hear reports of things I don't like.
Mr. Dillon, sir, we're wasting precious time. What you need to
know... I will be the judge of that, sir. Now, Commander, if you will, please examine this document. It arrived addressed to me and through me to the members of the Congress of the Confederation.
Again and again, honorable gentlemen, you have promised us half pay for life. A year has gone by and you have done nothing. You have lied to us, honorable gentlemen, again and again.
Lied. Note the insolence of that word.
I note its truth, Mr. Dillon.
Oh, come, come, General. Surely you know this Congress has no power to tax without the state's consent. And you know the states will never consent to give a whole army half pay.
Yes, sir. I know it, and you know it, and Congress knows it. So to promise these men such things is to tell a knowing lie, is it not?
Read it.
It may be dangerous, gentlemen, to trust forever the patience of your soldiers.
There you are, General. Now will you try to tell me that the Continental Army is not threatening the Congress of the Confederation?
What you have been warned, Mr. Dillon, is that liars, even liars in the highest office, cannot count forever on the patience of the people who elect them.
Oh, no? Well, soldiers, may I remind you, General, are not the masters, but the servants of the state. It is their patriotic duty to accept the lies of their elected officials, to believe those lies, and to execute their duty accordingly. If they do not, they should be court-martialed, the lot of them. Can't you discipline your own army, General?
You forget, Mr. Dillon, a government that deceives and exploits its citizens forfeits the right to their loyalty. That was the message of the Revolution to all rulers.
You dare. General, you are to dissolve this army at once.
On the word of one congressman? This is royalty with a vengeance.
I shall speak with the Congress. Tell them what I know, and they will command you. Will you obey them?
General Washington, sir?
Mr. Dillon, at this hour, pirates prey against our ships with careless contempt. Spanish ships forbid us the use of our own Mississippi River. Indians and mobs threaten us daily. British troops still occupy American soil. At any moment, war may again break out. I would tell this to Congress, sir, and at the same time warn them...
We are to be threatened if we have an army, and threatened if we do not. Is that your message to the Congress, General?
Freedom is always threatened, Mr. Dillon. Your only options are to meet those threats wisely or stupidly. What is it, Hawkins?
The army, sir.
The army, Hawkins?
They are in revolt, sir. Mr. Morris and Major Armstrong have just made speeches that have ignited the whole army. Tomorrow morning, they set out for Philadelphia to seize the government.
There, you see what I told you?
Who opposes Armstrong, Hawkins?
No one, sir. And when they march, no one in this land can stop them.
No doubt.
Betrayed, I knew it.
Sir, they beg that you will lead them.
And if not?
Then Armstrong will lead them. And you will be alone, sir.
They'll cut my throat. I'll never get out of here alive.
Hawkins.
Yes, sir.
Congressman Dillon is to be escorted safely out of camp.
Well, who is
you? You, alone.
Yes, sir. What is your answer to the army, sir?
I shall come to them tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Dress parade, please.
But your answer, sir?
Tomorrow morning, Hawkins. 10 o'clock.
Yes, sir.
At ease. Gentlemen, this morning I have,
Are you all right, sir?
My glasses, Hawkins.
Oh, I brought them, sir. Here.
Thank you, Hawkins.
What's the matter? Why the delay? Why don't
I beg your pardon, gentlemen. I ask your indulgence while I put on my spectacles. I have grown not only gray, but almost blind in the service of my country. If this were a public occasion, gentlemen, I should use it as I have used all such occasions to praise your courage and devotion to duty in the face of unimaginable sufferings.
Why, you're just trying to distract us, Washington.
Major Armstrong, have I lied to you this morning?
Well, no.
When I speak my first lie, please interrupt me again.
Yes, sir.
You complain, gentlemen, of the incompetence, indifference, corruption, and deceptions of the government to which you have committed your lives. Let the record speak. What man, first and most often and most forcefully, voiced these complaints to Congress itself?
That's why you must be our leader, sir.
Gentlemen, you honor me as always, and once again I thank you. But, gentlemen, I must tell you frankly of my weakness as a leader. No, gentlemen, I can lead only when I know whom I lead and why I lead them. Until today, I knew both. Now, I know neither. So you must tell me. Major Armstrong, who are you? And why am I to lead you?
You're asking me?
Yes, Major, I ask you.
Treated American soldiers.
Why, so you are. All of you. And if more mistreated than as British subjects, you should lay down your arms and beg King George to take you back. Shall we all do so, Major? Tell me where to lead you.
Well, all we want is justice.
And so do I. Now tell me, when you get to Philadelphia, what will you do?
We'll kill the slimy congressman.
Then who will right your wrong? Suppose Congress agrees to anything you ask. Suppose there is enough money for 5 years' full pay pension, and that's all. Will you accept it or reject it? You see, gentlemen, you are not a government able to face your own problems and solve them. You are a mob, able only to destroy others and finally yourselves. Is this to be the dismal end of our 8 years together?
Something has to be done.
Gentlemen, I've led you against a king whom our people did not choose, a parliament for whom our people did not vote, and laws in whose creation our people played no part. I have led you that we might have a government of our own image, laws of our own passing, and officials of our own election.
Well, that's what we wanted, too.
And you have fought and bled, and now you have it.
Yes! There's no more justice than before.
You can't have justice until you have liberty, freedom of choice. We've been fighting for a representative government in which all have a voice. That battle is almost won. Do you want to cast it aside to create a tyranny in which you yourselves are the tyrants?
Well, Congress cheats us, lies to us.
They do. But remember this. Your own states have given them the task of looking after you, but denied them the power to do anything about it. Congress can't raise a penny of taxes without the consent of all 13 states, and at least one state always refuses. What else can Congress do but lie, cheat, and pray for better days?
Then what are we to do, sir?
Look to the laws we pass. to the men we choose. What you are doing now, what you ask me to do, is to destroy your own instruments of choice. Yesterday I led you against those who would deny you your own representation. Now you ask me to lead you against yourselves, while you tear down the very hopes that were the object of our common agony. Major, I would sooner strike daggers into the heart of my own child.
Well, then,
how can we make anything better, sir?
So far, of our own choice, we have created a government too weak to do harm and therefore too weak to meet our most urgent needs. We must make that government strong enough to save us from starvation, from fear, from disintegration, even in the moment of victory. Then, so long as men are foolish and greedy, we must hold that government to strict account. Major Armstrong, you have a better plan?
No, sir. Not I.
Others? I thank you, gentlemen, for your attention. It seems to me that this so-called mutiny is now at an end. Hawkins?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for standing firm. Now then, would you like a furlough, Hawkins?
Oh, yes, sir.
You have a family, a girl waiting?
No, sir. No one.
Yet you're eager to be away. Why?
You'd be offended, sir.
Hardly as offended as I'm now curious.
I'm going to work against you, sir.
You're joining King George?
No, sir. Quite the opposite. You're an authoritarian. I'm going to work for questioning and challenge. Your liberty is a closed corporation for the few lucky enough to be wealthy. I'll work to make it open for everyone. I'm going to work for the principles of Thomas Jefferson.
Heaven save us.
I knew you'd be offended, sir.
I think not, Hawkins. I struck at the heart of my day's authority. It's reasonable that you should strike at the heart of yours. When one starts a revolution for the rights of man, who can say where it should stop?
The Mutual Radio Theater is brought to you 5 nights a week at this time. Tonight's original radio play, The Mutiny Against George Washington, was written by Edward Borgers and produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Your host was Lorne Greene. Our stars were Fletcher Markle and Tommy Cook. Featured in the cast were Len Berman, True Boardman, Harley Bear, Barney Phillips, and Byron Kane. The Mutual Radio Theater theme was composed by Nelson Riddle. John Harlan speaking. The Elliot Lewis production of Mutual Radio Theater is a presentation of CBI.
Mutual Radio Theater has been brought to you by Sears, a name that means quality and value. A name that you can count on for service and dependability. Sears, where America shops for value.
This is Andy Griffith. Join us tomorrow at the same time. I've got another story I think you'll find riotously amusing.